Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is Good Story number 107. Sorry, 108.
I jinxed you. I said 107 before.
Yes, earlier. Oops. We're going to talk about St. Francis of Assisi, the book written by G.K. Chesterton, which I really, really like.
I do too.
Occasionally we select a overtly religious book to talk about, and that's what we're doing today.
Yeah, this is a good one too, because not only is it about a saint, it's by somebody who was a notable Catholic influencing people in his own time and on into ours also. So it's an interesting combination.
It was, and that's exactly what the book is, isn't it?
It's, yeah.
It's not just about St. Francis. It's also about G.K. Chesterton.
Mm-hmm.
Him telling us mostly his message, it seemed to me, apart from, you know, St. Francis, was sort of a anti-modern thinking diatribe.
Well, pro-conservative.
Yeah.
What would you say? Progressive, maybe.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, but he said often, well, the modern mind doesn't seem to understand this, but you know, and then he would go on, or if the modern mind would look at something this way, I highlight a lot of stuff in the book. In fact, I almost practically dipped the thing in yellow highlighter.
Well, and Chesterton, though, was really well known for doing that thing of standing things on their head so you'd look at it a completely different way than usual. Mm. So good at that. And that's something that, oh, shoot, I can't remember. I could have sworn it was Dickens, but maybe it was Chesterton. Now, see, I don't look this stuff up, and I'm really sorry, everyone. But I think we might have talked about it before, the moronk or whatever it is, which is when you see the word coffee room from the other side of the glass, so it's backwards.
Huh.
And
I don't recall that.
Yeah, I feel like it's something that, like I say, either Dickens wrote it and Chesterton pointed it out, or Chesterton used an example. I don't know why I keep thinking of Dickens. But anyway, the whole idea was, because C.S. Lewis picked that up also, which was that when you see that very familiar word, before you realize what it is, you look at it and go, wow, this could be a whole different land, like a fairy land, like, you know, caverns to explore. And then you kind of adjust. And that's the thing that Chesterton did so well, is he would show it to you from a new angle so you could fit it into your context in a different way and understand it a little better. And he does that so well with St. Francis, because I've never been one who really grooved on St. Francis. I mean, I knew his story. I knew about him. And, but the way that Chesterton talked about him by saying, well, there are all these stories, but let's take one and look at what it shows us, really kind of helped open up what Francis was doing with his crazy saint ways and why he's still so influential today. And so I really liked the way he did that.
Well, good. Yeah, I liked it too. I liked it a heck of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting at the beginning, you know, Chesterton talked about, well, this is how I'm going to approach this book. And he says, you know, well, as I see it, you know, there's three different ways we could do this. You know, I could pretend that, you know, everything that he believed was a load of hogwash, basically. You know, he said something like, you know, I'll try to tell the story of a saint without God, which is like trying to tell the life of an expedition to the North Pole without mentioning the North Pole or something like that. And then second, you could go 100% religious, which means, you know, you're fawning over every possibility that his life held and every possibly legendary event with full faith and belief and, you know, ecstatic looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could go the route that he says that he's trying to do, which was sort of a trying to look at how he worded it, but it was like, you know, Well, here it is. The writer may put himself in the position of the ordinary modern outsider and inquirer, as indeed the present writer is still largely and was once entirely in that position. So he's trying to stand aside as a modern person, and looking at this person's life. But G.K. Chesterton is very much Catholic. He very much is a believer in the possibilities of St. Francis's life, you know, miracles included.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that it was excellent. I liked his approach.
I really did too. And I would say I liked the way he, in that third approach, he pointed out, he says, you know, there are a lot of elements of St. Francis that seem really at odds to each other. The really happy, joyful guy who was the extreme aesthetic, if I said that right, you know, who would fast and not use money and all this stuff. And he says, but this was one man. This was a man and not half a dozen men. What seems inconsistency to you did not seem inconsistency to him. Let us see whether we can understand, with the help of the existing understanding, these other things that now seem to be doubly dark by their intrinsic gloom and their ironic contrast.
Yeah.
And I really liked that whole idea of him just going, let's just look at all the puzzle pieces and see what it says to us, what each thing says to us about who he was, and maybe we can build this picture of the man himself. And I thought, in a sense, that's like having the four Gospels.
Yeah.
You know, each one is showing us their view or their way of telling the story to this particular different group of people. So you emphasize different things. And if you just sit and compare each thing across the Gospels, they may look very contradictory. But in context, they all fit together really well for the life of Jesus. So.
Yeah, well put.
Thank you.
Yeah, he said somewhere, I'm just looking for the quote, you know, which isn't jumping out at me, but he said something about, you mentioned gloom, you know, and he was these things, but he was not gloomy.
Right.
Yeah, so that would have been a good illustration of the, you know, he talks about the modern mind. Yeah, here it is. It's actually near the end, but he says it is, let me back up a little stitch. Okay, but whether or not any such lesser things will throw a light on the greater, I guess that sentence doesn't really mean a lot without the context, but it is utterly useless to study a great thing like the Franciscan movement while remaining in the modern mood that murmurs against gloomy asceticism. The whole point about St. Francis of Assisi is that he was certainly ascetical, and he was certainly not gloomy.
Mm-hmm.
So, a quick definition of asceticism. It says characterized by or suggesting the practice of severe self-discipline and abstention from all forms of indulgence, typically for religious reasons. So that's the definition of asceticism. But, you know, that's not something that a whole lot of us practice in the modern world, is it?
No, it's very much out of style. And I think maybe that's kind of one of the things I was thinking, that we were kind of making G.K. Chesterton sound maybe a bit gloomy in his own way when we were saying that he would talk, you know, more from a conservative point of view and not so much progressive. And maybe that was the wrong way to put it. In terms of what he would do is say, here's how the modern mind sees this. And then he would say, but from that point of view, here's why they were doing it. And maybe we're wrong not to think of it that way.
Yeah.
Of course, I love
Yeah, and I like that about this. Yeah. So, you know, there's you know, books written about, you know, the medieval mind and, you know, how they would think of something. You know, this made me want to reread Iflheim, knowing what I know now. You know, we had a course we shared on St. Francis of Assisi and a lot of that medieval stuff that they talked about. It'd be interesting now with this knowledge in the head to reread Iflheim and see what I think of it. It's Iflheim by Michael Flynn, that is.
Which was so good. And I don't remember the episode, but we'll put a link in these show notes.
Sure.
I would say, too, what this made me want to read, I've had a lot of things pushing me in this direction, but this, once again, made me think, Divine Comedy, I read it once, mm-hmm. and I need to reread it, because, of course, you could probably just keep reading it over and over, but I've had a lot of things come up, and he was a great influence on Dante, and they think Dante might have been a Franciscan. So, with in mind, I think... Oh, that just adds a new layer.
That is really cool. Yeah, it's one of my goals this year to read that.
Oh, is it?
It is. Yep. That's on my list of things to read this year. And it's already May.
Yeah, so maybe begin it this year.
Yeah, there you go. And when you say the Divine Comedy, is that...
that's all of it.
What is it?
That's...
Purgatorio is volume one?
No, Hell, uh-huh. or whatever it's... Inferno. Sorry, I knew there was
Inferno.
A better word.
Okay. Inferno, and then Purgatorio.
Inferno, Purgatorio, and then Heaven.
And Heaven, cool.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm reading a book... This is way off topic, but I'm reading a book right now called Heaven and Hell by Luis Marcos, and it's talking about all the ways in Western literature different great authors have shown us what they think of Heaven and Hell. Starting with, I think it starts with Virgil, but it might actually start even with the Greek myths about the Titans who got thrown into a special kind of hell to hold them in. And so he's going along, and I'm now on just finishing up John Milton and getting ready to start the Victorians. But it's really interesting to see what he says about Dante. And he was one of the inspirations that made me want to go back to Dante, because I thought, I didn't understand a lot of the last part very well, and that would be a good guide to take with me.
Nice.
Yeah.
Fun.
We're way off St. Francis.
That's all right. St. Francis, yes. But, yeah, Dante, very cool.
Well, so St. Francis.
Yeah, St. Francis. Yeah, he was born, what, in 1182 or so? 1181 or 1182. Mm-hmm. They're not absolutely positive when. And he was born to a rich merchant. So he was in kind of the rich class. I don't know that he was, you know, filthy rich or anything, but he was very well to do. His dad was a cloth merchant and took pretty good care of his son, sounded like, you know, as far as materially.
Sounded like he doted on him to me, because he gave him a special nickname. Francis was a real unusual name, or Francesco or whatever it would have been, because it meant France, didn't it? Which was super trendy at the time. So funny to think of that.
Super trendy.
It's like naming him Apple or whatever the most current trendy name is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he grew up there, and then Assisi was in some kind of a tussle with another town.
Perugia.
And he ended up, I can't remember the name of it, but he ended up going to war, and his dad bought him, you know, a suit of armor and everything that he'd need. And off he went to war and ended up getting captured and was a prisoner of war for a while until his dad paid the ransom, which his dad did do. But that war changed him, it seems like.
Yeah.
When he came out of there, he looked at the world differently and really felt... like, you know, is any of this worth anything? I guess that's what happens when they lock you away for a while. But that was kind of the beginning of what I think, I can't remember if Chesterton said it specifically, but it was kind of a slow conversion where he just became more and more devout and as time went on.
Yeah, because he was a big playboy too.
Yeah.
At the same time as he was... You know, that he would do things like run off and give a beggar a lot of the money he'd made from selling cloth. But at the same time, he was a huge playboy and a troubadour, you know, that real joyful, let's go sing around town, romantic songs to all the ladies.
Yeah, he was the guy everybody wanted to come to the party.
Made me think of St. Augustine in that way.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that leapt to my mind was St. Ignatius.
Yes.
When he was, you know, he was a warrior and fighting quite a bit, and Chesterton said something about the joy that St. Francis felt while doing certain things and how they were more than the joy he had while doing the things that he thought that he wanted to do. And as time went on, he started to recognize that for what it was. And I remember St. Ignatius talking about the same thing. Oh. When he was trying to discern what to do and with his life, he would think about certain thing, and the joy that he felt while thinking about it made him think, that's the way I should go.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. I was thinking of the commonality of being a soldier, and I don't know if Francis was vain. That was never really spoken of, but, you know, St. Ignatius' vanity that he had the leg wound and he was going to walk with a limp, so he made them re-break the leg or whatever. And so I'm like, oh, man.
I'm going to need you to fix this, right?
And so while he's holed up all day, he's like, oh, give me something to read. Well, we have a Bible and we have saints' lives. Enjoy.
Enjoy,
he came out of it converted, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, so, yeah, that just triggered those thoughts, you know, the thought of a suit of armor and going to war and ending up different and ending up where he went.
Well, and I liked... And I think Chesterton talked about this. I know that the teaching course?
Yeah, the teaching company.
Company, that's it.
Yeah, and the name of the course is St. Francis of Assisi.
Yes, and you very kindly shared that with me. And it was really illuminating because when I went back and looked at St. Francis of Assisi by Chesterton, I had already read that. He was making a lot of the same points. And one of the things I liked is, like you said, a lot of this stuff came naturally. You know, you were talking about St. Ignatius, but they talked about St. Francis. A lot of these things came naturally, such as he would normally in that time period find a lady who he would do things for. You know, that would be the troubadour part of him. And instead of a regular lady, he found Lady Poverty, who he embraced, and he became her man, basically. I thought, I just love that. I love the idea of God taking what you're naturally inclined to and you're just kind of off target. And him going, no, over here. This is where you can really, really love your life. And I'll use it too, because this is what you were made for.
Yeah.
You know, which would explain the joyful embrace of poverty and asceticism.
Yeah, and that I have this highlighted. So G.K. Chesterton wrote, "The reader cannot even begin to see the sense of a story that may well seem to him a wild one until he understands that to this great mystic, his religion was not a thing like a theory, but a thing like a love affair."
Yes.
And that's just what you were describing, the same kind of a thing.
And that's what Chesterton is so good at getting at, because that links right up with one of the other things I loved that he said, where he said he didn't love Christianity, he loved Christ. He didn't love humanity, he loved men. It was very personal, you know, and that's that love affair that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And
very cool.
Yeah. And the whole idea that he says later that he devoured fasting as a man devours food. He plunged after poverty. You know, he was passionate and dramatic about stuff, but he was so sincere that he was like, oh, this is the way it goes. Yes. Which is how he could be joyful about all that.
Right, right.
He wasn't dragged into it. He dove into it.
Yeah, he did. Right. He dove into it.
Yeah.
And so one of the ways that he did dive in was he had a dream. So he's still, you know, with his father or with his family right now, you know, they don't talk much about his mother. Mm-mm. I don't know what was going on there, but he had a dream that told him to rebuild the church or rebuild the church.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And he took that to mean, okay, well, what I need to do is build some buildings. And he immediately took some cloth from his father's stores and sold it, and then used the money to buy some materials so he could rebuild a church. And he started to beg for building materials. Well, this upset his father greatly. Which culminated in, a sort of a public square moment where the bishop of Assisi and his dad and he basically things were being, he was, judgment was passed on him that he was guilty of stealing that cloth, and he basically said, fine, here's all your cloth back. He took all his clothes and he said, I renounce you, I renounce possessions. And off he walked, wearing nothing but a hair shirt, off to his life.
Well, the bishop threw his cloak around him, so.
Right, and that's a good, that's a important detail, too.
Yeah, because that was symbolic of, now you're under the church's embrace.
Exactly, exactly. And then right after that, he went to live with the lepers. you know, which is another formative, I mean, there are these formative events that occur, like when he first met this leper, or a, you know, not mm-hmm. a specific person, but a leper, and how he felt. That's where I started to make that Ignatius connection, how he felt when he was with that leper and doing something for that leper as a step towards his conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so then after this incident, he ends up now living with lepers. And he starts to gather followers under those circumstances. Some people just start to say, you know, that's a good way to go. I think I'll do that too. And I can just imagine what it was like in that town, you know, having these, you know, young men go down to live with the lepers while with St. Francis, you know, with Francesco, right?
Right. Well, and some
the charismatic Francesco
weren't even that young, right? I mean, right. Like some middle-aged guys who were merchants and
he moved people. I mean, it was pretty clear to me right at the outset that he was moving people.
He was very charismatic, I have a feeling, because he was popular. I mean, I felt like even when he was just the playboy, he was popular, but it wasn't just because he'd pay for the party.
Right.
I just felt like he was one of those people who just everybody loves. And when somebody changes that radically and they're joyful about it, and it's clearly, I'm going to be like Christ, I think it's, you know, it moves people in ways that we can't predict. Because most people would look at that and go, it's just nuts. I mean, when you think about it, think about the conditions to take care of lepers. And I think on one hand, how grateful those people must have been to have anybody look at them as a person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think about what you had to ignore to be able to do that. Rotting flesh and terrible conditions. And you do have to have God moving you to do that, I think. I mean, yes. You know, to give you that inspiration.
Yeah, no question. You know, to do it without fear.
Right.
You know, to accept, well, whatever the consequences might be, I am going to do this. And you know, is there a more dire consequence than giving yourself to that situation?
Well, and then it's like Brother Damien and was it Molokai? You know?
Not sure.
Oh, the leper mm-hmm. colony in one of the Hawaiian islands.
Oh, okay.
And this is mm-hmm. much more recent, obviously. I think it's clipper ships and things like that. But he had a calling, and he went off, and he lived there with them. And in fact, it was because the danger of infection was so great, nobody knew how to treat it, that when he went to give his confession, another ship would bring a priest in, and he would have to have a boat take him out, and he would have to yell his confession to the priest because you couldn't have physical contact. That's how it was carried.
Wow.
And in the end, he got it and died of it.
Oh, goodness.
But he lived there and took care of them because, you know, that's what you do. And it's funny, you know, think of how many different people we're seeing these strands go to from Francis's own life that you don't think reach out that far. But a lot of these saints have these echoes of what Francis did in the 13th century. It's kind of what, maybe that's what Chesterton meant when he said he was the only Christian. I don't really believe that, but I
well,
I was really
he said
by that.
What Christ is the only Christian, and Francis was the only Franciscan.
Did he? Is that what he said?
Yeah, that's what the quote was.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't say Francis was the only Christian. He said Christ was. But I don't even know if he was a Christian.
I thought he was saying he said Christ was pre-Christian, and I went, "Oh yeah, yeah. I guess he was." I forgot. Oh yeah, okay.
That is true. I've got to find that.
I'm confused, I guess.
No, but I'm almost positive because I remember being struck by that same passage, and I was, but I can't remember what the point of what he was saying was. But but it's interesting, like you're saying, there's a lot of echoes throughout that. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, I'm not finding it. I've got the Kindle version here, so I thought I'd type Christian, and I got like 20 things.
Considering
here,
let me type the word "and."
Yeah.
And I don't think I marked it, which is kind of silly of me. But anyway.
Now, one of the things that struck me really quickly in this book was in chapter 2, he was describing the world in which Francis lived, and the last paragraph in that chapter just blows me away, because what he was saying is Chesterton was that we were coming out of the Dark Ages, right?
Yeah.
So here is a figure, you know, so St. Francis is at the very tail end of the Dark Ages, you know, again, 1181 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So in the, you know, right around 1200. Here he comes, and this is his sentence or paragraph. It says, "While it was yet twilight, a figure appeared silently and suddenly on the little hill above the city, dark against the fading darkness. For it was the end of a long and stern night, a night of vigil, not unvisited by stars. He stood with his hands lifted, as in so many statues and pictures, and about him was a burst of birds singing. And behind him was the break of day." I just love it.
You don't expect something that lyrical from G.K. Chesterton.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
But it really was, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I thought so.
Well, and I really liked his description when he was talking about the Dark Ages that led up to this period, because this is another way, I think, when this book was written, in the 1920s, maybe? Maybe before that. 1924 is what my book shows. Anyway, you know, it's only been recently that I've come across people suddenly saying, you know, the Dark Ages weren't really as barbaric as the people right after them made it sound, and that we've always taken their word for it. They did that because they thought of them as barbaric because they were better. And when they go back and look, a lot of things were much more enlightened. And that's really what G.K. Chesterton already said that in here.
Yeah, he sure did.
He talks about how it was a transitional time, but there were a lot of things that were really, really positive, really good, and much more advanced than most people would think. And I thought that's another one of those things that when you first read that in 1924, it must have really stood people on their head.
Hmm. Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a you know, a friend who used to talk about the Dark Ages, and he says, "No, they were not the Dark Ages. They are not. That's the worst name ever."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, that's such a good point, and yeah, he talks about that. It's a fascinating period to think about. Yeah, men at the close of the Dark Ages may have been rude and unlettered and unlearned in everything but wars with heathen tribes, more barbarous than themselves, but they were clean.
Yeah.
They were like children. The first beginnings of their rude arts have all the clean pleasure of children. We have to conceive them in Europe as a whole living under little local governments, feudal insofar as they were a survival of fierce wars with the barbarians, often monastic, and carrying a more friendly and fatherly character, still faintly imperial in so far as Rome still ruled as a great legend. Yeah, I mean, the whole chapter is like that. It's great.
Well, one of my favorite parts was when he said, "Pagans were wiser than paganism. That is why the pagans became Christians. Thousands of them had philosophy and family virtues and military honor to hold them up. But by this time, the purely popular thing called religion was certainly dragging them down. When this reaction against the evil is allowed for, it is true to repeat that it was an evil that was everywhere. In another and more literal sense, its name was Pan. Hmm. And so he's talking about, yeah, it's that transition into the world that Francis could come into, that it was, I think that teaching course is the place where they said that Francis had a harder job than a lot of the earlier people because he was having to talk to people who didn't know they needed converting. Well, I'm Christian. I go to church. And mm-hmm. I thought, wow, that's almost like our time.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I'm just like, wow, you know, is this like today? Mm-hmm. We need a St. Francis.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was the same thing. And it's fascinating to read this. The other thing that was notable kind of around that same time he was talking about that was, you know, he was saying, okay, at his time, the church was already really old.
Yes. You know,
it was like 1100 years old.
Yeah.
And you know, we're almost as far away from Francis as Francis was from Christ. It's pretty close.
We're a couple hundred years closer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? Just
amazing. It is amazing. So, but yeah, you know, what you said there, that struck me as well. It's just like, you know, we've been here before, and it was comforting in a way, because mm-hmm. as soon as, you know, I read that, I'm like, holy cow, we were here already. And I know that's something that Chesterton talks about in another one of his books is, you know, the times at which the church could have failed and yet is still here is
yeah.
just amazing.
Right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I loved it. I love that. Lots of very cool stuff. Mm-hmm. There was one thing that I have highlighted here that I thought was interesting, but I puzzled over it. And, he says, it was something very puzzling to some people, something clearer as a rule to Southerners than to Northerners, and I think to Catholics than to Protestants, the quite natural assumption of the equality of man. The reason that he was bringing this up is because later on he says, Francis, I fancy, felt a real doubt about which he must attend to, the beggar or the merchant.
Oh, yeah.
And having attended to the merchant, he turned to attend the beggar, and he thought of them as two men. And what happened there in that incident is he was dealing with a merchant selling cloth, and a beggar came to him and asked for alms. And he said, well, I'm dealing with this merchant, and now you know he's trying to deal with them both, but he turns his attention to the merchant to finish with him, and then he turns to the beggar, and the beggar was gone. So he chased after the beggar and gave him money. When he found him, but the point was is that Francis was not seeing this as a rich person and a poor person. He was right. seeing them as people, and so the thing that was puzzling, you know, it says it was something very puzzling to some people, something clearer as a rule to Southerners than to Northerners.
Yeah, I don't,
and I think to Catholics than to Protestants. That was a puzzling statement to me. That could be something that maybe was going on at the time
yeah.
that he wrote it. Maybe.
Or he just needed to throw in another sentence to explain why some people wouldn't have thought of it that way, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know if he was also thinking, you know, the way people at that time maybe would have... Well, I guess he was yeah. talking about his own time, wasn't he? Because he was saying Protestants and Catholics.
Right,
but
right.
I don't. Yeah, there's nothing obvious yeah. to me.
Nothing obvious.
He's anyway. Puzzled us.
Yes, he's puzzled. So, yeah. So St. Francis, he's there with the lepers and things, and then, he starts to gather more and more people, and he ends up with an order, and. He just is it at this time, you know,
goes
I mean,
to Rome.
we're really skipping over the very top edge of his life here because
yeah.
and that's really what Chesterton's doing. He's not delving. He delves into these specific events, but it is by no means a comprehensive biography. It's an introduction.
Right.
Yeah. So, but Francis later on, he decides that he needs to go get official.
Yeah.
Right? Become
yeah.
an official movement or an official monastery or
no,
order.
No.
He wanted to be an official
you'd
order,
have to
right?
Own something for that.
Exactly, exactly. And that was something that you know he was doing. It was forbidden you to own anything. You know
right.
That's you know that was his thing. There's going to be no ownership. So he goes to Rome, and he ends up meeting the Pope. And well, one of the things in that course that you mentioned that was interesting is as they were talking about it, they said, you know, it was probably as hard back then to meet the Pope as it was for if I went to Rome to try to meet the Pope.
Yeah.
They said that it probably wouldn't have been that much different. But yet he climbed the ladder basically because he knew the Bishop of Assisi. And the Bishop of Assisi would pass him on to somebody who would pass him on to somebody else. And somehow he talked his way all the way up to the Pope. And somebody said, hey, you should meet this guy. And not only that, but can you imagine Pope Innocent III
mm-hmm.
being confronted with a guy who's just like, hey, and he's wearing rags, right?
Yeah.
He's wearing a brown habit, which is not common garb back then.
And a rope for a belt.
And a rope for a belt. And who has a lot of things to say. And at the end of that conversation says, okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's mind-boggling to think that the Pope would respond that way. And again, it's another sign. You can view that how you want. But to me, I think Chesterton says something about that in this book where he's like, you can doubt the reality of the religiousness or whatever like that, but you can't doubt the reality that he met the Pope. And the Pope agreed with him.
And the cardinal that got him into contact with who was high up enough to get him an audience with the Pope became the next Pope.
Yeah.
So he was connected both ways.
Right. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And
unlikely at the very least.
In the Louis de Wolle, if that's how you say it, book about St. Francis, he said, it's a historical fiction, but Hughes pretty close to what you would think is the actual truth on this
stuff.
That's
the one I want to read the most.
Yeah, it's really a good one. But he says that Pope Innocent had been having dreams, that the church was falling down, and there was a strange guy who he'd never seen before who was holding it up. He was holding the walls up.
Mm, yeah.
And so when he met him, he's like, whoa, what? Hey, hello. I think I know you.
He's saying, yeah, what I want to do is I want to go preach to all these people that are already Christians.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, you know, ended up doing that. But yeah, that's interesting, the dream aspect of it.
Yeah. And of course,
now, Pope Innocent III was one of the big ones too, wasn't he? He had a lot of stuff going on.
Oh, right. The Crusades.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And wow. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Let's see. Pope Innocent it says 1161 or wow, he couldn't have reigned that long. That must have been okay, there it is. He reigned from 1198 to 1216.
Oh, okay.
So 20 about 20 years.
Okay.
Yeah. 18 years.
Okay.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
That's John Paul II territory.
Right. Right?
Yeah.
Not quite there, but you know.
Yeah, yeah. it's of a kind, right? A generation,
right.
Really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a lot. So, but yeah, that's just fascinating to think about. You know, again, I just like Chesterton pointing out things like, you know, you can doubt
mm-hmm.
some things, but you know, when, you know, you can't doubt that this happened, you know, these are factual information, you know, and whatever you think that the motives and the causes were, this is remarkable.
Right. That's just not yeah. done.
Right. Right. And I like that.
Well, and evidently it was growing by leaps and bounds to where it was international very soon because people would just join in and you didn't have to. I mean, you had to have the right sort of spirit for it, I guess. But since you were basically begging to live for a living, helping people, sleeping wherever you could, they didn't need monasteries. I mean, later mm-hmm. they did when they were trying to handle all the people, but that was something that Francis always fought. So, but it was growing by leaps and bounds, and even that I guess that must be the first religious order that had a third order.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is when, like, somebody like me could say, I want to be Franciscan but still live my regular life. And they would say, okay, well, you come on and you're going to do all these various things to get you in the Franciscan way of living and praying and the mindset. And you're going to go through all these, I guess, courses and prayer things and spiritual direction and retreats. And then once you've done all this stuff, then you'll have various meetings every so often and pray in this way or do these various good works or whatever it is that we do for our order.
Right.
And a lot of these religious orders have this. The Dominicans have them. And
yeah, the Benedictines.
Yeah. But I thought maybe he was the first one to do that.
I think you're probably right. I don't know any different on that. Yeah. But yeah, it was a good idea.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah. So here's G.K. Chesterton on the growth that you're talking about. He's talking about how he grabbed a rope and put it around his waist. And then Chesterton says he undoubtedly meant it as a shabby expedient, rather as the very destitute tramp will sometimes tie his clothes together with a piece of string. He meant to strike the note of collecting his clothes anyhow, like rags from a succession of dustbins. 10 years later, that makeshift costume was a uniform of 5,000 men.
Wow.
And 100 years later, in that, for a pontifical Penelope, they laid great Dante in the grave.
Mm.
Yeah. Amazing. 100 years after that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yep. So he was. I mean, people were just like showing up for that party.
Yeah. And the other thing I really loved that Chesterton said, and everybody seems to agree on this too, is that he was the man who could not get killed. He wanted to be a martyr so bad. That was part of going to live with the lepers. And I mean, not also to help people, but you know, it's like, I can be a martyr. I'll, you know, do this. I'll do that. I'll go talk to the Sultan who's attacking all the Christians and
yeah,
you know, and I guess,
and that was something too. Yeah. I mean, for him to do that, yeah.
What? Because no one
just
kind
of march. Yeah, it'd be like you could go talk to Bin Laden and say, "Hey,"
or ISIS.
Yeah, or yeah. I mean, how would that go right now if Pope Francis went and talked to ISIS? I don't know that it would go very well for Pope Francis.
Well, and you couldn't.
I mean,
it's
scary.
Yeah, you couldn't even say Pope Francis. It would just have to be if this priest you know took one of his good friends.
That's true.
And they paid their way, and they went over there and said, "We really want to talk to you."
Yeah.
Because that's kind of how it went for Francis.
And then the chances that you would never see them again are pretty darn high.
Right, and that's what you would think here. You'd think they'd be killed in a horrific way because that's what was going on. And instead, what winds up happening, according to the stories, is he winds up shaming the Sultan's, well, they're not called priests, but holy men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not deliberately, just by being Francis, just by the Pope saying, so, you're going to jump in that fire? Sure. I'll jump in the fire, brother fire. Yeah. And he looks at his, you know, guys, and they're all like, oh, I'm sorry. Did I tell you I have an appointment right now? It's really a bad time for me to jump in a fire.
Oh, man. Amazing.
But I also liked that very straightforward attitude of even if he wasn't going for martyrdom, he was willing to. But the whole idea being, why kill all these people as Muslims? When what we need to do is point out to them what they're missing by not being Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really the way it should be.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it should be. And then, you know, along with the acceptance of their own choices.
Right, exactly.
You know, and we just ask for the same in return.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. If only...
I myself am not going to be going to the Middle East anytime soon. I'm no Francis.
Right, right.
But that is, of course, I guess that's reminiscent of, did you see that video that was done? Gosh, if I could remember. who it was who did it, which was a message to ISIS. Oh, wait, here it is.
Oh, I did. I think I saw it on your blog.
The cross to ISIS.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's, let's see if I have who did it. I have it here to copy into my quote journal. I haven't done it yet. Mm-hmm. But it's basically it's basically a plea for that very thing. Saying, you know, you can kill us, but love is coming for you because we've made terrible mistakes. You're making terrible mistakes, but there is forgiveness available for everybody.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, how bold. And I haven't even, why did it never occur to me to even think that way and pray for it?
Yeah, no question.
You know,
it's certainly what we want. I mean,
well, because these are, if you look at them not as what, as Francis did, right, as humankind, but as men, how many of them are wretched in what they're doing right now? Or just so mistaken they can't see it any other way?
Right.
Surely
right.
That's what we have to pray for, is that they can not be like that, because they, nobody wants to be like that.
Yeah.
Really.
Right, right. And again, Chesterton. It is assumed that equality means all men being equally uncivil, whereas it obviously ought to mean all men being equally civil.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
That goes in the pool room.
That's really, he was so good at the soundbite sort of thing.
Yeah, he really was.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of moments where you read something in there.
So many.
Yeah. There's one that's a little off topic, but he said something. He was actually quoting someone else about atheism. And it says here, Rossetti, whoever that might be, I'm sure it's a philosopher. Rossetti makes the remark somewhere, bitterly but with great truth, that the worst moment for the atheist is when he is really thankful and has nobody to thank.
I was thinking that was a poet. What, weren't there Christina Rossetti?
I don't know
the wrong name.
Yeah, so then, Christina Rossetti.
And then she had a brother.
She wrote much religious and love poetry and children's verse. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that may be who it is.
And then she had a brother also who was maybe an artist.
Yeah, painter? Look at you go. She was the sister of Dante Gabriel Rossetti.
I feel
how cool
very
a name is that?
Learned. Very learned, everyone. That's,
well done.
That's all
well
I know,
done.
So don't ask me anything else. I think it's because I just read that book by Paul Johnson about art, and so I would have thought about it that way. Well,
nice.
Yeah. I just, you know, nobody thinks about, you know, when you put together all these pieces of St. Francis's life, I bet unless you've just read a book like this or have a particular devotion to St. Francis, most of us would think of two or three pieces of his life that are familiar to us. Not all this stuff, including going to see the Sultan. No one seems to remember that very much. But everything, you know, you think of his famous attachment to nature and his canticle, Brother Sun and Sister Moon, and the fact that he preached to the birds, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Christ said, say the good news to all creatures or something. And he was like, done. Brother Rock, here you go, whatever it is, you know. So,
Yeah.
But it was kind of interesting because what Chesterton points out is that he sees everything as being connected. So if you're doing that to the birds, somehow it's affecting people too.
Yeah.
Or the people that see you doing it or what.
Right. Yeah. He did say something like that. And that was interesting. Yeah. It was all like one big thing, right?
Yeah.
Which is what Catholicism really is. You know?
He saw each tree. There was no such thing as a background. Mm-hmm. Everything was in the foreground for him. And I guess I didn't mark, let's see, any of this stuff, but I just remember thinking, oh, that starts to make him come into focus more.
Yeah, it does.
All that. Let's see. Now, for Francis, St. Francis, nothing was ever in the background, We might say his mind had no background, except perhaps that divine darkness out of which the divine love had called up every colored creature one by one. He saw everything as dramatic, distinct from its setting, not all of a piece like a picture, but in action like a play. A bird went by him like an arrow, something with a story and a purpose, though it was a purpose of life and not a purpose of death. A bush could stop him like a brigand, and indeed, he was as ready to welcome the brigand as the bush.
Mm.
Or maybe that's a bad piece, because it's hard to find good pieces that really sum up from Chesterton, I found. But It's just that whole idea that he just kind of wove it all together into one seamless whole.
Yeah, I like that. I think that he did that very well. Yes, and we must mention St. Clair.
Oh, yes.
What a story that is. You know, I don't think I have a clear understanding about, you know, well, you know, what happened before that. But Claire was really his first female follower, and she ran away from home, and he didn't he accept her into the where they were living or something like that, and then her hair and everything,
yeah,
and then
according to she was really holy her whole life. You know, she was never like, you know, how Francis and Augustine were the playboys. But I think the way it goes is that she was holy her whole life, but she had a very great attraction to what Francis was showing in terms of holiness, to that way of living and to being, you know, attracted to Lady Poverty, I guess. Yeah. But of course, her family, her father wanted her to get married, of course. And so she had to sneak out. They had to arrange for it on, I think it was Palm Sunday after Mass. She snuck out of the back, and he took her into a church where there was a priest waiting, and they shaved her head and basically made her one of them. Not part of his brotherhood, but part of, you know, that same religious cause. And then she went off. Somehow she was accommodated, and I'm not as clear on the details of this, but she was able to start a convent, basically. And her mother and her sister joined too.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that. Yeah, and I know she was a problem for the bishop as well. I mean, I say a problem. I mean, but it was he didn't know what to do. Because he's like, okay, what we'll do is we'll give you some land and a house, and you can live there and have, you know, a monastery. And she's like, well, that would mean that I would own something. So no thanks, we'll be fine. And he's like, how do I protect you, you know, in this medieval world? How do I keep you from harm? She wasn't interested in that. Mm-hmm. She was interested in not owning anything. And she says, we'll be fine. You know, don't worry about us. But he's like, but I have to worry about you.
Well, and I don't know exactly how they managed it, because she did actually have, whether it was owned or whatever, she did actually, they lived and closed. And they sewed altar cloths and things like that.
Yeah, and then that was at that church that he made or rebuilt, isn't it?
That's where she ran away to. But then later, because one of the things that I liked was the teaching company course did say the interesting thing about Claire is that she was her own person. She was one of the people who very early on had to interpret this idea of casting off possessions and giving your whole self in this radical way, but for women in that society, which was not like Francis. They didn't go wandering around the countryside. They had to have a different way of doing it. And they did, because I think they're usually called the poor Clares, not just the Clares. Right. So they somehow managed it. So they were living a life of, you know, poverty and...
Yeah, I would like to read about her as well.
There's a little more about her in that Lewis DeWole book also, just to get things started. That's where a bit of knowledge comes from.
Well, I am definitely getting that one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Cool.
But...
Wow.
But he was... It's funny because he himself was... He'd go around from town to town and preach. You know, you're supposed to tell the good news. But he wasn't mounting big crusades. He wasn't, he didn't really even have a direction. Like, the Dominicans started about the same time, but they were clustered around the universities because they were teachers. Wasn't that it? Teachers, yeah, and yeah. Philosophers and everything. So naturally they had to do that. But his thing was just, nope, poor, be poor, embrace Lady Poverty.
That's right.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess that was kind of like one of those reset buttons that just helps you get a better perspective on what you've been considering is important.
Yeah. And I think that that's a reset button that I need.
Yeah.
It's just something that I, you know, it speaks to me. That does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just like the thought. So maybe I'm going to go find a brown habit to wear around. Unfortunately, you know, not unfortunately.
You checked with the wife on this.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And I said, unfortunately, but that's not what I meant.
No. Oh. Just for that Franciscan bit of you.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe I can be of the third order.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, but it's when you think about it, and you look at scripture and you look at the Psalms and you look at how many times Jesus said, do not worry. You know, the birds don't worry about gathering up grain and they're still here all the time. The, you know, lilies of the field, look at how beautifully they're dressed. They don't think about it.
Yeah.
What is your, don't worry about your life so much. God will take care of you. And of course, it's that fine balance. Because we have to worry some, or we're not providing for our loved ones, and we're not, you know, being helping others and being responsible and doing all these things. But on the other hand, you have to not let the planning and the possessions overtake your perspective, because then that becomes the center of what you do worry about.
Right.
And it's kind of a balancing act that we do need a reset button from, just to pull back every so often and think about and.
Yeah, and just remember, yeah, not the most important stuff. You're not going to be carrying this stuff with you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, and I, like I say, I really never felt that much of a connection to Francis, but after this, I do feel more of one. He's probably never going to, now I'm saying this, I'm doing it myself. He's probably never going to be one of my favorite saints, so I just feel like, hey, pal. Not like Saint Augustine.
But he's the Carl Urban of saints.
Oh, no. That's Saint Augustine. Sorry.
Oh, Carl Saint Urban. Augustine. Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, any of you who ever go to our blog, read the tags. For the each post. I'm just telling you, even if you never go to the blog, go there someday and read the tags that Scott puts on these posts. They are so freaking funny. And if Carl Urban ever paid any attention and had any decency for my extreme appreciation for his skills and looks, he would definitely at least drop us an email.
That's right.
Now, what that had to do with letting the things of the world go, nothing. It shows how far I have to go.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Oh, yeah. Well, I guess it's pretty close to time to wrap this up. But
we're down to Carl Urban.
Yeah, we're down to Carl Urban. But I wanted to talk about Pope Francis just for a moment.
Yes. I
found a talk that he gave very shortly after being elected Pope. It was on the 16th of March, 2013. In which he talked about why he picked the name Francis. So these are, you know, translated from his words. It says, some people wanted to know why the Bishop of Rome wished to be called Francis. Some thought of Francis Xavier, Francis de Sales, and also Francis of Assisi. I will tell you the story. During the election, I was seated next to the Archbishop Emeritus of Sao Paulo, and the prefect emeritus of the Congregation for the Clergy, Cardinal Claudio Humes, a good friend. When things were looking dangerous, he encouraged me. And when the votes reached 2/3, there was the usual applause because the Pope had been elected. And he gave me a hug and a kiss and said, don't forget the poor. And those words came to me, the poor, the poor. Then right away, thinking of the poor, I thought of Francis of Assisi. Then I thought of all the wars, as the votes were still being counted, till the end. Francis was also the man of peace. That is how the name came into my heart, Francis of Assisi. For me, he is the man of poverty, the man of peace, the man who loves and protects creation. These days, we do not have a very good relationship with creation, do we? He is the man who gives us this spirit of peace, the poor man. How I would like a church which is poor and for the poor. And that's from the center of that talk or the address. Interesting.
Well, and I think not only in those ways, but in the way of being lovable mm-hmm. by a lot of people, he also emulates Francis, because I can't tell you how many people who are not Catholic have, once they find out I'm Catholic, they immediately start praising Pope Francis.
Yeah, I get the same.
And not for reasons like you might think, which is what the newspaper likes to make sound bites incorrectly out of, mm-hmm. current social issues. It's because he speaks from the heart. He speaks directly and simply. He speaks about things that everybody knows matter. And mm-hmm. it's kind of like my priest said for me, he goes, well, if my Pope was going to be, if we were talking about my Pope, Benedict would have gotten another 20 years added onto his life. But I have come to a much greater appreciation of Pope Francis, both after reading this and after reading this book that I have the galley for. It's called, Encountering Truth. The Truth, I think, is what it's called. Mm. And it's something like 185 of these homilies that he has done during the week at St. Martha's Chapel, and it's during morning mass, and that mass is for the staff of the Vatican. So you got gardeners and cooks and some journalists and some other people that have been invited that day, but it's pretty small, and he does it as their priest. And so, it's surprisingly, well, it's just surprising. Let's put it that way. Mm. Because each one is no more than a page and a half, say, and it goes through a year, a liturgical year, basically, from right before Easter to, during Lent of the next year. But each one will take something very simple out of the readings for the day, which they kind of list where you can find them at the bottom. But he always has some unusual twist. And it's always simple, but it's almost always something I hadn't thought of. And it's making me appreciate the way he thinks a lot more, because I had just been seeing sound bites and things from various homilies also.
Sure.
So it doesn't give you a chance to kind of see the way his mind kind of works along. And when you're reading them from, say, 2 weeks in a row, you start to notice, oh, here's a theme. And I'll say, oh, remember 2 days ago we were talking about this? Well, now let's look at it from this direction. Oh, remember last week when we talked about this? Now let's look at it this way. And
interesting.
Yeah. And you kind of think, I already knew, like I say, that simplicity and directness is what the world needs today, obviously, from the way people are acting. But then when I read that, I kind of think, oh, I see more of that connection to Francis here. You wonder if when he was going around doing that stuff, it was like when he did the manger scenes in the church, which I never knew.
Yep.
And you think about, as the teaching course guys said,
yeah.
And what would an ox and an ass do wherever they are? Your fine church might not be that fine for that long. And I thought, oh my goodness, that is the reality mm-hmm. that Jesus was born into, and he's going to make everybody experience it.
Yeah.
How interesting. Yeah. And it's like that,
Right, right. Love it.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. So what's the name of that book one more time, please? The truth one.
I believe it's called Encountering the Truth.
Encountering the Truth, okay.
It's going to have to, it comes out June 16th.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, and it's really good.
Cool.
Then the
noted
DeWol one is called The Joyful Beggar.
Okay, The Joyful Beggar.
Yeah.
Yeah, Well, great. Well, that was fun. Thanks for reading this.
I'm glad you picked it.
Yeah, it is one of my, you know, I had read it a long time ago, and it's always stuck with me.
Well, and it was more straightforward than the St. Thomas one, which I thought was kind of interesting. And the St. Thomas one that Chesterton wrote keeps referring back to the St. Francis one. Kept going, what?
You remember when I said this about St. Francis?
Yeah. Or, well, unlike St. Francis, with this and this and this, and he goes off on St. Francis for a long time. I'm thinking, I really could have sworn I was reading about St. Thomas Aquinas. Go figure.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Well, cool.
Yeah,
all right.
Thanks for picking it. It was great.
Hey, you bet. You bet.
And we hadn't read any Chesterton up to this point either, so.
No, we haven't. Too. So a double win.
Yeah, I like his style. Yeah. I have to kind of get into the rhythm of it before I can really. It takes a couple chapters, but then
yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, sure enough. All right, cool. So what do we have next? 2 weeks. Double Indemnity.
Oh, yeah. How come I keep forgetting that? I'm excited.
Cool. And then Mockingbird by Walter Tevis.
Yes.
So I better get busy on selecting the two after that.
I guess so.
I will. Get her done.
Yeah, because I already have my book for after that.
Love
Uncle
it.
Tom's Cabin.
There we go.
It's nice and long. Get ready.
That's great. I'm ready. It's sitting there on my Kindle. Waiting for my attention.
Well, and the stupid thing is, I was telling my husband, I said, now we're going to read this. And I was like, I need to see if there's a decent reading of it on like LibriVox or somewhere. And he looks at me, he's like, are you kidding? And I went, oh, right, I read it on the Forgotten Classics. Not sure if I trust my reading, I guess.
Yeah, anyone but that one.
Yeah.
No.
You don't want her. She's not like
Yes, you do. I give it a listen, everybody.
Yeah.
Just an
episode.
Yes. That's great. All right. Well, we'll see you in a couple weeks, everybody. Thanks again for listening.
Yep. Have a great couple weeks. We'll talk to you soon.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.